Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So Boris Johnson has swapped numbers with Jean-Claude Juncker. Katie, how did that phone call go?
So we have the phone call between Jean-Claude Juncker and Boris Johnson. And what both sides said was you had the European Commission president congratulating Boris Johnson on his appointment as Prime Minister. They did talk about Brexit, and the suggestion was made that should Boris Johnson want to negotiate and have a serious discussion, they could. But I think this felt caveated, or at least the reading has been, in the sense that Boris Johnson's rhetoric is something that was described as combative by Michel Barnier, who is the EU's chief negotiator. And I think that when you look at those words, there is a sense that the EU main players are not currently willing to work with what Boris Johnson is suggesting in his speech. So I think the general sense is, if you have a serious workable plan, we'll talk to you, but we're not going to do it. You're just saying we're getting rid of the backstop, because they find that unacceptable.
Yes, James, and as well as Barnier's tough words, Tusk has also written a letter saying, look forward to speaking with you, full stop. We have quite a cold way in his letter.
Yeah.
How have the Europeans been reacting to Boris Johnson in general?
So Donald Tusk is more emotional about Brexit and Boris Johnson and Jean-Claude Juncker. I mean, it was Donald Tusk who talked about a special place in hell, and it was quite clear that Boris Johnson was one of the people he was referring to when he said that. I think there is a tension set up by what Boris Johnson said in the Commons yesterday, which is essentially, we're happy to talk whenever and wherever, but we've got to talk on the basis that you're prepared to change the withdrawal agreement. Jean-Claude Juncker in the call yesterday afternoon was very clear that they're happy to change the political declaration, which is not legally binding, but they're not happy to change they're not prepared to change the withdrawal agreement. And so at the moment, there appears to be a kind of standoff that make any kind of substantial talks very difficult. And I think we can wait to see what happens. At the moment, it does appear that both sides are beginning to get the blame game in early about whose fault it would be. I mean, the big question for Boris Johnson is this, is at the moment, the kind of question whether the EU will, in inverted commas, blink, is a kind of academic one, because the EU still thinks that Parliament will find a way to stop no deal. It is, you know, encouraged by what Philip Hammond has been up to in the House of Commons, and also by the interviews he's been giving in the European press, and by what lots of people are telling the ambassadors in London about what they can do, EU ambassadors in London about what they can do, they still think that Parliament will find a way. If you come back, and in that September, you know, Parliament comes back for 2 weeks in September before they go off again for this party conference recess.
Right.
If we get to the end of that two-week recess, that two-week short session in September, and Parliament hasn't managed to do anything at that point to stop no deal, then I think that's when things get a lot more interesting. Because at that point, the EU side will have to start confronting the fact that really, Boris Johnson might take Britain out on no deal if the EU isn't prepared to compromise at all.
So, Katie, is the ball in Boris Johnson's court this summer at all? Is he going to go on a charm offensive with EU leaders, or are we just waiting for September at this stage?
Well, we've seen Boris Johnson say when he gave his speech at the dispatch box that his side were ready to negotiate wherever, whenever. But you do get the sense that this is a government which is making a lot of promises, talking tough on its Brexit lines, and isn't going to be going around almost seeking permission to speak. So I think that they will want to really ramp up the no-deal preparations, because Boris Johnson does believe by preparing for no-deal, it doesn't happen. And in that sense, put pressure on the EU. Now, the problem is on the EU side, they don't, I think, yet believe that he really can do a no-deal Brexit, at least not one straight without going to a general election or a public vote, perhaps a second referendum. And they are still of the view that that would probably work in the EU's favour in terms of getting a Labour government or Remain, even if the polls don't necessarily suggest that would really happen. So Boris Johnson, I think, needs to somehow make this threat seem real to them for it to have the effect that he wants it to have, and getting them to look at this Brexit deal or a new Brexit deal with fresh eyes. Because I think one of the biggest challenges for Boris Johnson is he has filled number 10 with all his Vote Leave comrades from the official Leave campaign and the EU referendum. Now, if anyone shouldn't feel daunted by the task, and Boris Johnson, when he became leader did say, you know, do we feel daunted to the crowd? They didn't say anything back. He suggested he didn't. But if anyone shouldn't feel daunted, it should be that group, because they have been thinking about the UK's exit from the EU for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But in the 3 years that they haven't been in number 10 and Theresa May has, a lot of decisions have been made and they're entering a completely different situation than had they straight after the EU referendum. So I think one of the biggest challenges is how do you reset the dial and start to have the conversations they wanted to be having 3 years ago, which are really hard to do now because Brussels just doesn't want to listen.
Right. And James, one person who's not on that in crowd is Steve Baker. The ERG member rejected a job from the government yesterday and he seemed to be leaving Downing Street in a bit of an upset. What happened there?
Steve Baker essentially thought that the job he was offered was too junior and not powerful enough. He was offered the junior ministerial job in DECSU.
So the same as what he had before? Or?
Yes, but DECSU is a different department now than it was before because the no-deal planning now, which is what Steve Baker had been doing in DECSU before, that is now concentrated in the Cabinet Office with Michael Gove running it. I think Steve Baker is... how do we put this? Steve Baker doesn't have a low opinion of himself. And I think that... I mean, he considered running for leader himself, it's worth remembering. He didn't in the end. He backed Boris Johnson. And so I think he might well have expected that he would be sitting around the cabinet table. And instead, he's not sitting around the cabinet table and he's been offered a job that he doesn't feel is commensurate with his importance.
And I suppose, given that Jacob Rees-Mogg got leader of the House, he probably expected that he would have got something similarly juicy.
Yeah, I think he wanted a kind of big substantive role and he didn't think the offer was there. I think this does tell you something, though, about Boris Johnson and his kind of instincts. You know, him and Steve Baker are not natural bedfellows. And this was going to be a kind of slightly uneasy alliance. And I think there was a lot of frustration when, you know, there was this meeting of the kind of the top bods in the ERG had Johnson and Raab in the leadership campaign to decide who to back. And I think on the Raab campaign front, there was a kind of slight frustration that the ERG decided to back Boris rather than him, and there was a surprise. Steve Baker was very key to that decision. He was kind of deeply suspicious, apparently, of Dom Raab in those discussions. But I think the challenge now is, you know, can Boris Johnson keep Steve Baker on board? And what is Steve Baker's reaction if somehow, for obvious the reasons we discussed before, this isn't necessarily likely, if Boris Johnson comes back with a very different withdrawal agreement and brings it to the House of Commons, how does Steve Baker and the other hardliners in the ERG react? Now, Mark Francois on Newsnight was saying you could bring the withdrawal agreement back with literally the backstop kind of ripped out of it, and he would still vote against it because there are other objectionable things in the agreement. So I mean, that suggests there is probably a kind of permanent hardcore who would almost vote against any deal. And the question is whether Steve Baker, who undoubtedly has formidable organisational skills, ends up with that hardcore or not.
Katie, how much trouble do you think Steve Baker will make for Boris Johnson? I mean, his tweet after this rejection of the role, he says, "I have total confidence in Boris Johnson to take us out of the EU by 31st of October. Disaster awaits otherwise."
Yeah, slightly menacing. I think in terms of how much trouble Steve Baker is going to cause Boris Johnson, it's all about this deadline, really, and whether or not the UK leaves. And as James points out, what the terms the UK leaves on are. I think that Boris Johnson's rhetoric so far is that he's not looking for a small change. He wants to get rid of the entire backstop. Maybe that wouldn't be enough for Mark Francois or Steve Baker. But you do wonder if they might push it over the line eventually. I think if you think about the EU referendum, Steve Baker played a really important role for the Leave campaign because he mounted almost these guerrilla tactics in the Houses of Commons when David Cameron was Prime Minister and also rallied all the fellow like-minded Eurosceptic Tory MPs around to do various things to push the cause. Now, I think that where Steve Baker is perhaps less of a problem now is how many comrades does he have around him who are willing to go as far as him and have such like a militant Brexit line? I think that if you look in the European Research Group, Jacob Rees-Mogg is now in the cabinet. He is the leader of the House. But he is someone who has a significant role to play. So that group is not all on the same page as Steve Baker.
Yeah.
And I think the vast majority of the group of the European Research Group want to give Boris Johnson a chance, because they do think that if Boris Johnson can't get the UK out of the EU, who can? Maybe it's Nigel Farage for the Brexit Party, but I think that's a very small number of the European Research Group. So although I think it could be difficult, I just don't think currently he has the support. I think it's a very small group.
And James, Katie writes on Coffee House this week that Boris Johnson this summer is planning a tour of the Union. Tell us about that. What is he planning on doing?
Well, one of the big challenges for Boris Johnson is his popularity or lack thereof in Scotland. There are a couple of reasons for this. First of all, you know, why are the Tories still in government? Because they made gains in Scotland at the 2017 election, so he needs to keep those seats. Secondly, Nicola Sturgeon, you know, never misses an opportunity to talk up the prospects of a second independence referendum. And thirdly, there is a view that, you know, Scotland voted to remain, over 60% of Scots voted to remain. In a way, it's remarkable that 30-odd%, 38% I think it was, voted to leave, given that there was almost no leave campaign in Scotland. But anyway, having said that, and there is absolutely no doubt that the SNP would try and use the disruption of a no-deal Brexit to try and push the case for another independence referendum. Although, square brackets here, I do think the case that the SNP would have to make for independence after a no-deal Brexit is actually much harder.
Okay.
Because essentially, it is a much more dramatic rupture if the UK is outside of the EU. So if Scotland is going to join the EU and the UK is outside of the EU, then you really are talking about friction in trade between Scotland and the rest of the UK. Scotland would be essentially choosing to prioritise the EU single market over the UK single market, when four times more of its exports go to the UK single market than the EU one. So, I mean, all of that is true, but I think Boris Johnson will need to find somewhere to do that. And he doesn't have the easiest relationship with Ruth Davidson. And that relationship hasn't been helped by the fact that, you know, he's got rid of David Mundell as Scottish Secretary, who was close to Ruth Davidson. If you want to hear what David Mundell thinks about being got rid of, you should go and listen to him being interviewed by Katie at the North Berwick Literary Festival.
Next week, isn't it?
Yes, I think this is the time for me to do a shameless plug. So I am interviewing David Mundell, and at the time of arranging it, we thought he'd be the Secretary of State for Scotland still. That has not happened thanks to the Boris Johnson government formation, but I think if anything, it should be a more lively discussion. So if any of our listeners are in Scotland and able to make it, it's on the 8th of August in North Berwick at Fringe by the Sea. And all the details can be found on the festival's website, which is www.fringebythesea.com.
And so I think that this is a kind of challenge for him. So how does he find a way to resonate in Scotland?
Yeah, yeah.
I suspect what we're going to see is a kind of infrastructure love bombing, essentially. But it will be, and the relationship between Boris Johnson and Scottish Tories will become quite transactional. So, you know, when the budget comes in September, I suspect that there will be a bunch of things that the Scottish Tories can say are wins. You know, expect the Scottish, I mean, Ruth Davidson has wanted this before, and I think she will revert to this strategy. She will want the Scottish Tories at Westminster to behave not quite as brazenly, but a little bit like the DUP, in terms of, we will support you, but we want the following things in exchange.
And Katie, news of this tour of the Union has fueled speculation that Boris Johnson is preparing for an autumn general election. Do you think that's fair enough to say that he's on the campaign trail?
This is a government in campaign mode. If you look at everything they've done since Boris Johnson was picked, and then since entering number 10, that speech, it was not a speech about managing expectations. These are big pledges. He talked about all the things he wanted to achieve on Brexit, said the buck personally stopped with him, talked about solving social care, something that successive governments which have had majorities which are much larger have failed to do. So I think that everything you're seeing him do, the fact that they're doing these tours and getting him out there, yes, it's about establishing him as the Prime Minister and trying to give him a boost. But I think it is in the back of everyone's minds that this is a very fragile Parliament.
Yeah.
And Boris Johnson's cabinet appointments are not about trying to bring the party to a state of unity so it might last another year. They're just really going hell for leather on Brexit and hoping for the best. Now, I think in an ideal world for the Boris Johnson camp, what happens is, they, as James explains very well in his cover piece, is they get this poll bounce and they start to seem more popular with the country. And then from doing that, MPs start to play ball. Brussels perhaps looks at the things a different way and then thinks, actually, we have to take this government seriously. But if that doesn't work, I think they're very aware that you could be heading to an autumn election, and that is why they're doing lots of these things too.
I mean, Michel Barnier's note, which predictably leaked, essentially said in not so subtle diplomatic code, if he carries on like this, there's going to be an election, so let's not worry too much about what he said.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that we'll have to disentangle here, which is quite tricky, is this is a government in campaign mode. But it's in a government in campaign mode, but it's hoping that by being in campaign mode, it doesn't have to have an election before October 31st.
How so?
Because, essentially, if by being in campaign mode, it can get a big bounce in the polls. It can get the Tories up to, say, 32, 35% of the vote, quite comfortably ahead of the other parties, given that we're now in a four-party system. What they would hope that at that point is that MPs would look at the maps and think, oh, God, if we brought the government down, all we get is an election in which Boris would come back stronger because he'd have a majority. So let's back off. You know, this is a dynamic that before she went to the polls in 2017 and lost her majority, Theresa May benefited from. You know, in that period between 2016 and 2017, when she had, I mean, Boris Johnson is going to get poll leads anything like the ones that she had, but when she had those big poll leads, what would happen is part something would come to Parliament that Parliament didn't like about Brexit, and Parliament would start saying it was going to do something, and then it would essentially back off because it thought that, okay, we don't actually want a situation where Theresa May goes to the country and comes back stronger. That's what Boris Johnson will be hoping for, and that's what all this campaigning and all these kind of, you know, very popular policy pledges that they're rushing out are about.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And to hear what Conservative MPs think about an early general election, why not check out this week's Spectator podcast, where Isabel Hardman and James speak to Simon Hart MP, who was one of the founders of the Pragmatic Brexit Delivery Group. Thanks for listening, and do join us again tomorrow.